I'm wanting to lead off today with something of an examination of what is the experience of education, or what does it mean to be an educated man or woman in our society at this time in history? What are our notions collectively on what it is to go through an educational process here in the 1980s? And what does it mean to come out something of an educated person with a degree or a high school diploma or a professional career track or whatever it might be? We want to ask ourselves the questions, what does it mean to be an educated person? And then on Wednesday, which will be the second session with which I'll be involved, I want to treat a subject entitled Ethics, Education, and the National Psyche, particularly because of what we've been going through these last few months under congressional hearings and questions about our involvement with other countries in the Near East and the translation of monies received from interactions with countries there, particularly Iran, affecting the economy and political life and international relations right in our own hemisphere, right here in our own continent, for example. And asking ourselves if our educational climate and certain conditions fostering education have anything to say about the way we view the events of the last couple of years and now the events under investigation that affect our national psyche. The third experience together on Thursday will concentrate on the whole notion of human service in an age of self-interest. And we have been told more and more frequently in the last decade that the students entering college in this time are more concerned about themselves and their own future, their own jobs, and how much they'll earn, and what kind of style of life they will have, than they are concerned about human service, such as was elicited in the 1960s and continues down to today with the Peace Corps, such as has been elicited through the church with various avenues of volunteer service and missionary activity around the world and experiences like that. And finally, on Friday, I want to open up the subject of faith and learning. Are these experiences compatible or antithetical? And talk together about the whole notion of what the church says about the notion of faith, as well as the notion and process of education, and how our own lives have been intersected with both faith and learning. So that's what I aim and seek to be about with you in these days. And I thought I would open our session together this afternoon by reading a little thing written by Robert Fulghum that I heard for the first time at our baccalaureate service just about 7 or 8 weeks ago on the campus of California Lutheran University. And I think it touches the very heart and core of what education is all about. And not only at the kindergarten level, but perhaps throughout life. I know that some of you have heard it before. I dare read it again. It's entitled, All I Ever Really Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Most of what I really need to know about to live and what to do and how to be, I learned in kindergarten. Wisdom was not at the top of the graduate school mountain, but there in the sandbox at nursery school. These are the kinds of things I learned. Share everything. Play fair. Don't hit people. Put things back where you found them. Clean up your own mess. Don't take things that aren't yours. Say you're sorry when you hurt somebody. Wash your hands before you eat. Flush. Warm cookies and cold milk are good for you. live a balanced life. Learn some and think some, and draw and paint and sing and dance and play and work every day some. Take a nap every afternoon. When you go out into the world, watch for traffic. Hold hands and stick together. Be aware of wonder. Remember the little seed in the plastic cup. The roots go down and the plant goes up, and nobody really knows how or why, but we are all like that. Goldfish and hamsters and white mice and even the little seed in the plastic cup, they all die. So do we. And then remember the book about Dick and Jane and the first word you learned, that biggest word of all, L-O-O-K, look. Everything you need to know is in there somewhere. The golden rule and love and basic sanitation, ecology and politics and sane living. Think of what a better world it would be if we, all, the whole world, had cookies and milk about 3 o'clock every afternoon and then lay down with our blankets for a nap. Or if we had a basic policy in our nation and other nations to always put things back where we found them and clean up our own messes. And it is still true, no matter how old you are, when you go out into the world, it is best to hold hands and stick together. So it is not only with a touch of good humor, but with a note of seriousness that I entitled this presentation and this discussion today, All You Really Need to Know You Learned in Kindergarten. Because the basics, as outlined here by Robert Fulghum, I think really have touched the basics of living throughout the years. We amplify on them, we make them more sophisticated, we give greater breadth and range and touch to these basics. But the basics of learning and growth and fairness and care for the self and respect for others and learning more and more year by year about the larger nature and character of the world, we did pick up in these basics of kindergarten. We translate these in another kind of way, it seems to me, in a college such as California Lutheran University, or all of the colleges as I know of them related to the Lutheran tradition in this country, and we have 28 colleges and universities associated with the new Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, or for that matter in most of our smaller private independent colleges around the country. And I would go even further to say in most of our undergraduate education in our colleges and universities across the land, we would emphasize the extrapolation of this kindergarten education, if you will, into some sense of liberal learning or liberal studies or an education in the liberal arts and sciences that we would see to be basic. Now, this doesn't happen in all colleges and universities. It doesn't happen in schools committed to technical or business education, for example, where their focus and their direction are more along particular tracks that those institutions are committed to. But in a general education experience in most of our colleges and universities, there is a kind of commitment to an education that would help a student to emerge with a degree in which it could be said that person has a liberal education, or that person is committed to liberal arts and sciences that helps one to know about the larger sense and frame of the world in which one lives. And so we might ask ourselves, well, what are the marks of a person liberally educated? And it seemed to me, as I thought about this, some such simple but clear and direct commitments as this: that a person who has a liberal education, that is, who started out with this kindergarten point of view and has taken the breadth of the world and a sense of the self throughout these years seriously, should come out being able first to think clearly. And that may sound so simple to say and to share with one another, but we would all be surprised at how many students come through high school and into college these years, and they have not learned to think clearly, to put a sentence together accurately, and to develop that further into a paragraph that holds together, and then know when to end that paragraph and start anew in developing a thought process. And so we would contend that an educated person ought to be one who can think clearly. And one that flows then, secondly, directly from that, is a person who can speak clearly or intelligently. A number of us in the room have had backgrounds in graduate education, or particularly in theology and various service occupations with the church. And some of the emphases we've been given there in our studies throughout the years have associated themselves directly with these kinds of emphases, with being able to think clearly and then to get this out in expression through teaching and sermon and group leadership and the like. And that ought to go almost without saying, that leadership ought to be able to speak intelligently, to speak clearly in order to convey ideas. But again, it isn't always so. A third point that flows from the first, it seems to me, is that an educated person ought to be able to write well. My wife works in a company that is committed to high tech, particularly the development of software in many instances for government, military projects and the like. And she will often discuss with me, the engineers and the other people very technically oriented in the company know their subject matter exceedingly well. But to put it into a form that can result in manuals and descriptions of the very projects on which they're working is one of the most difficult tasks that they face. To be able to put it down well on paper, to communicate it meaningfully to others, to write well, it seems to me, is another mark of an educated person. A fourth would be that the educated person have a sense of history. One's own personal history, where one has come from and the meaning of that, and that often is not taught in school, but rather learned from parents, from conversations within the family circle, from experiences in a place such as Holden or one's own family reunion. But to know one's own personal history, it seems to me, gives one a sense of place in the world and helps one to know a little more who she or he is as one goes through the years of other inquiry and probing and decision about career or professional track or marriage or home or value or whatever it might be. A sense of history, one's own personal history, the history of one's country or land or state or region, the history of the world. And when one talks about this, perhaps it seems like too much of a task to grasp all of this in a world that is constantly expanding and growing with a kind of knowledge explosion. And yet, each of us needs something of these take-hold points, something of these handles to know oneself, one's own sense of value and purpose and history, as well as something of these marks of the surrounding world. And how far one goes with this probably depends upon personal whim, personal interest as one gets into it more deeply, but some sense of the history of the self and the history of the outside world around the self, it seems to me, is essential to being an ever-emerging educated person. A fifth point in the sense of what an educated person ought to know in the expansion of kindergarten learning, and that is a sense of proportion, or one might speak of this as having a knowledge of mathematics and related fields. In our own day, this is expanding rapidly into some understanding of the computer and how things flow logically and fit together. And the computer has helped us to know about those relationships and the rapidity with which numbers can be put together and logic can be stretched out and decisions made, such as we'd never known prior to a decade or two ago. And exercises and reactions are being achieved today in microseconds that literally took years to achieve 20, 30, 50, and 100 years ago. So a sense of handling mathematics and numbers and proportions and how things fit together, it seems to me, is something also that marks the educated person. A sixth is that of having some understanding of human life and the processes of the world around us. What subject areas would these touch, we might ask ourselves? It seems to me that we start to get a lot of this with the kindergarten child, learning about the white mice and the goldfish and the hamsters and their forms of life, that then find extrapolation or expansion or enlargement as we go through the years of study, such as in biology, the sense of self in psychology and sociology as to how groups of people and systems fit together or conflict in our society. We get it through such subject areas in terms of knowing our world as chemistry, physics, and in a setting like this with Dr. Edmund, knowing the very environment that shapes us and of which we are a part, and the setting that surrounds us. So it's in that sense that I suggest that having some understanding of human life and what makes human life go, and how human life and animal life so closely associated with us is kept healthy and alive and invigorated and stimulated. And the other side of that coin is the non-animate life that surrounds us, the processes of the world in terms of the chemical formations, the geological developments over the centuries, and all that that impacts our self-understanding of human life as well. And then beyond that, it seems to me that an educated person, as with the kindergarten child, deals with a constantly expanding life of the mind, dealing with ideas, dealing with the movements and thoughts of peoples. And that's what's happened in the history of civilization down through the years, literally. We've heard about the thoughts and the ideas projected of the great philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, and the like, down to our own time. We've heard about the great religious teachers, notably in the Christian tradition, of course, Jesus and Paul and Luther and Thomas Aquinas and all the rest that have informed the world of ideas, both the world of the mind and the world of the spirit, that have affected and shaped and transformed the entire human family and the entire character and nature of civilization generation by generation. And with all of this then has come something of a sense of the world of which we are a part in ever refreshing and ever changing ways. And when we get to this in terms of the college curriculum and seeking always to keep a college or university curriculum alive and fresh and timely, at the same time that it respects all that has come before it. Colleges and universities today frequently speak of having a core curriculum or a curriculum that has general education at its heart that will hold together many of these basic experiences or disciplines down that have developed down through the centuries and that hold together in the kinds of ways I've just been sharing with you here today, but that also will offer a kind of creativity and open door to knowledge and disciplines that are becoming new right in the life of the university of today. For example, when most of us in this room were in college or university studies, we didn't even have the word computer in our vocabulary. Today, probably 20 to 25% of our students in colleges and universities across the country are either majoring in computer science or computer information services or some computer-related field, or find it to be a very strong component of their studies in order to lead on to something else. A career in business, a career in scientific research, a career in the aerospace industry, a career in going back into college education, where they may need to do statistical analysis that's rooted in the computer, and all of those kinds of things. And all of that has happened just since most of us in this room have been in the college or university classroom. It's happened in the last 20 years. It's happened in a very focused and intentional way in the last 5 to 8 years on most college and university campuses. Right around the turn of this decade, 1980, 81, 82, just about every college or university in the land was seeing the need to help their students become computer literate. And there was a great rush to get not only mainframes, that is the large computers that could do all kinds of things across all kinds of departments in the university, but to get many personal computers on the desks of students or faculty members or in departments where the students themselves could actually have hands-on experience and learn firsthand with their professors how that computer applied to the particular discipline or subject matter they were dealing with, or simply to become at home and acquainted with what a computer might do for them in their own personal lives and growth. That's only one example. Another might be in our time is a new discipline that we're inaugurating at CLU this fall in laser technology, or fiber optics, or electro-optics, all of which are somewhat interchangeable terms in terms of applying this new field of electronics and optics to an ever-expanding area of communications, telecommunications, and laser technology as it relates directly to a host of other fields. Medical research, the wide range of telecommunications around the world, and all the rest. And these are only two examples just in the last 10 years that had become new fields of study and inquiry in colleges and universities, fields of inquiry that didn't exist 10 or 20 years ago. To play this out a little further in terms of how a teacher sees the value of the learning process, I want to quote, pick up a couple of quotes from an article written by Alice Reich, who is a professor of anthropology at Regis College in Denver. And she writes the following, "Why I teach. I keep teaching because it is for me the practice of what it means to be human, to have a voice that names the world in relation to one's own experiences. And so I have tried to learn how to teach by asking myself, who were my best teachers? My parents were better teachers than many that I encountered in most of my years in school because they taught me to learn everywhere. There were a few fine teachers, good in different ways. One was patient, another full of enthusiasm, another brilliant, but another whose ideas came at the right time for me and my ideas. But I learned the most from friends, because in friendship one finds reciprocity and no compulsion other than the force of discourse, no oppression, no violence of any kind. And in reading this over once again, I thought about the nature and character of sharing in this kind of place. Love of my material and the support of my friends and colleagues are vital, but without hearing the voices of students, I could not continue to teach. She goes on, I have learned the most about teaching from my students. I have learned that allowing them to see my mind working on confusing issues is more instructive for them and less exhausting for me than presenting myself as one who knows all and mystifying the processes through which I became so knowledgeable. I have learned that I don't have to be all things to all people. Students who don't learn with me may well find other teachers with whom they will learn. And I have learned that the silent preposition in the sentence, I teach students, is not the word to or the word for. It is with. I teach with students. As a teacher, I hope to convey to students the joys of critical thinking, a way of being in the world that may not give much comfort, but one that makes life interesting. I hope to show them that caring passionately for ideas has to make room for the possibility of being wrong. I want them to know that I am critical, not because I think life is not worth living, but because I think it is worth living better than most of us are doing it now. That's why Alice Gregg teaches. And then a couple of other background references for opening up some discussion among us. Otto Friedrich, in an article written about 4 or 5 years ago in analyzing what education in our society ought to do for our young people, says there are five major areas that education ought to touch. And it's education that, from his point of view, leads toward mature people and maturity in the sense of service in the world. He writes, first, that education means work, career, or profession. And education leads one into a track such as that. Second, education transmits civilization. And it's all of that that I was really alluding to in my opening kinds of remarks, that the kindergarten child becomes a participant, if you will, in the ongoing process of the transmittal of what civilization at its best is all about. And the more that gets amplified, the more that becomes rich and meaningful for more people, the better is the education process. Thirdly, education teaches how to think, says Otto Friedrich. Fourth, education liberates the individual. And that set off in my mind some new thoughts, that education is itself a liberating influence. I think we have seen more of this with minority young people, ethnic minority young people in our society in the last 20 years than perhaps we were sensitive to in some decades or generations before that. To see a young black or Hispanic child get to college, get to have the opportunity to have more of an education than they had ever dreamed even was out there, let alone than they'd ever dreamed might be possible for them. To see that child have that kind of opportunity and his or her whole life blossom from such an experience is to see liberation, a new sense of freedom, a notion of opportunity emerging such as you see it in few other ways. Education liberates the individual. And finally, Otto Friedrich writes, education teaches morality. And he goes on in this article talking about these five ingredients of education in the American society today by alluding to the fact that, yes, we have had Supreme Court decisions in our lifetimes that have discounted certain areas of religious teaching in the public schools and all of that. He goes on, nevertheless, to say that education has brought about more people more sensitive to equality of opportunity, to equality of the races in our society, to helping men and women to know in a better way and in a larger sense the opportunity for progress, for sharing, and the like, than has been true probably in many generations prior to our own time since World War II. And that sense of morality, of rightness, of a sense of opportunity, of being fair, if you will, with the kindergarten child to all people, our place in the world among nations, and a growing sense of balance and proportion in that kind of way is a part of what education in the society ought to be about. And finally, I want to read some excerpts from a recent report entitled Higher Education and the American Resurgence, which is the product of a committee chaired by Frank Newman, and the report written by Frank Newman. And he touches on the crucial significance of an ever-vital educational process in our society for keeping the American dream alive and for keeping this country on the forefront along with other countries in our changing times as being absolutely central. Newman writes, "The attention of domestic and foreign policymakers concerned about economic growth has often been focused on high technology. Understanding the actual implications of advanced technology is critical in understanding the role of higher education. While the initial surge of interest was often unrealistic and narrowly focused, that is, high tech often meant only computer and semiconductor chip manufacturers, the debate has since become more sober and realistic, but no less urgent. By any analysis, there is a revolution of advanced technologies, computers and semiconductors, of course, but also software, biotechnology, pharmaceuticals, new materials, scientific instrumentation, telecommunications, and many more. These diverse fields share two characteristics: dependence on advanced technology and the development of innovative new products through creativity in the application of those technologies. Policymakers have come to see the need to address both sides of the issues, increase the already huge pile of technology, and enhance the ability of companies to create new products by the use of technologies selected from that pile. The real issue for the United States, then, is the need for all of industry to understand and master the concept of perpetual dynamism. Things are constantly in change, and if we think they've changed rapidly in the last 20 years, these changes are only issuing in many, many more changes. And the notion of education today is also then to take account of that kind of dynamic. See it as a positive. See it as that which is opening up new areas of vision and of the collection of data and the transmittal of information in ways that were indeed dreamed of and thought to be central to the scientific process in generations past, but today the dynamic and the speed of transmission is simply overwhelming many times." Newman then writes at another point, "Our colleges and universities can once again play a central role in national renewal, the American resurgence. Our system of higher education is the world's best, he argues. It must be even better, even more effective, since new and powerful forces are reshaping American society, increasing the demands placed upon higher education. In a world where we once were technologically far ahead of most other nations, we now find ourselves in serious competition with nations considered emerging only a few years ago. And Dr. Newman argues, our financial system, telecommunications, and countless other aspects of today's life are so intertwined with the rest of the world as to have changed permanently. Today's economic competition is a far cry from what it was just 25 years ago. Not only have Japan and Western Europe become more sophisticated in manufacturing and technology, but newly industrialized countries, Taiwan, South Korea, Singapore, Hong Kong, Israel, are hard on their heels as well. The result is a dynamic world market, a never-ending economic race, which the United States leads, followed by Japan, then Western Europeans, who are in turn pressed by emerging countries such as Brazil or Mexico. In his report, Dr. Newman argues persuasively that colleges and universities have a crucial role to play in helping America meet emerging competition. But beyond confronting the realities of a global economy is the issue of whether the United States can provide moral leadership as well. And this little section is concluded then with this statement: if the need to respond to the new world economy were the only force for change, it would be essential that higher education respond. As important as this is, however, we do not believe that it is the most urgent issue. The most critical demand is to restore to higher education its original purpose of preparing graduates for a life of involved and committed leadership. And in a similar vein, Newman writes about the challenge for higher education. To meet this challenge, higher education has a crucial role to play. The nation's campuses must not only be places where the tradition, the transmittal of the civilization, is honored and the culture preserved, but where students are educated for creative thinking as well. Classrooms must be places where new ideas and self-confidence are encouraged. And my closing comment is that offered by the current president of a banking company in Chicago, whose name escapes me right now, but whose quote is this: education is not a destination, it is a process. And I dare suggest that the process begun with the kindergarten child and everything that he really needed to know or that she really needed to grasp, being contained in that kindergarten classroom, is also the enhancement of what needs to be done in the classrooms of colleges and universities across the country today, only in ever-expanding form. That's what I'd offer by way of an opener on the educational process. I would invite challenge or disagreement. You might talk about questions such as this: what is the purpose of education as you see it? What kinds of courses or disciplines or tracks ought to be offered? And perhaps a question: what is the role of the teacher in the educational process?
Basis. And people are buying activities and learning how to do activities with newborn children, 6 months old. I think it's very, very dangerous that our culture is not thinking in terms of all these wonderful things you've been talking about from birth on rather than from kindergarten on, because we still have a K through university mentality, in spite of the fact that the most crucial years in human development are being taken up on an institutional basis by people who are not necessarily very, very well prepared and are so grossly underpaid that they are leaving the field, that just about the time they get some experience under their belt, they realize they can't live on this income and they leave. So we have two kinds of people working with these little, with our young Americans at the most crucial stage in their development. One is entry-level people who have, you know, good education perhaps, but no experience. And the people who are experienced are people who do not expect to ever earn more than entry-level pay, and their motivation isn't very high for professional development. And they don't necessarily have the intelligence to use the material that's coming out of research in universities. They can't apply that in the classroom because they just don't have the smarts to do it, nor do they care, nor see the purpose of it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. It may even be that the influences begin in prenatal terms of the psychological well-being of the mother and the character of the relationship between
but
father and mother.
At least it's institutionalized now.
Not to speak of genetic influences and all the rest about which we're learning more these days. And I know next to nothing about these except to know that we've got people like Mike Kalitsky that do exploration on genetic influences and the changing and improving of certain kinds of genetic influences on the whole birth process. Carry that out then throughout life. I think you're absolutely right that it's a continuum that probably begins at conception and continues for all of us sitting here today. Other comments, yeah?
I agree with that. I think there's a much larger problem, our infatuation with high tech. I think we've really lost sight of something that started, but I think has died out. I think we're going to have problems as long as we teach about minorities only to minorities, as long as we continue to ignore at least one-third of the world's culture and thought processes, abysmally ignorant of how they work. And we have little requirement. They may be offered as elective courses, which how many people are interested in. And so we go on with this American dream that our culture is that to which everyone must aspire, and that everyone who has not arrived at that point is therefore inferior. I think that is still being taught, if not specifically in so many words, simply by omission of these things that we need to have people to learn about, that there are other ways of doing things. Just like when we sent in missionaries all over the world and or to many countries anyway, and the first thing they tried to do was westernize as part of Christianity, that it had to be Western style, dress and food and everything else.
Aren't they getting away from that?
Well,
yes, I would hope that in the mission field, but when we're talking about colleges, now what does Cal, I don't know, I'm not that specifically acquainted with every college's program, but what does your college do in such fields? Are they required to study Oriental culture?
We haven't come very far in those areas. And I think you put your finger on a good subject area of fostering intercultural and international studies. We have at our small university totally about 2,500 students, about 1,500 undergraduates, and we have more graduate studies and more ethnic minority students and more international students than most of our sister Lutheran schools, but even there we're relatively small. We've got about 8% of our student body is made up of international students from about 22, 23 countries. We see that as a highly valuable experience in international studies and international relations, just with the presence of those students on campus, with international dinners and interaction of the international students with the entire student body that is possible in a school our size, choral work, drama, athletics, and all the rest. We have about 13% of our student body is ethnic American ethnic minority background. Largest groupings, Hispanic, Mexican-American in background, black and Asian, and then American Indian in that order. What we haven't done is a very good job in any of our institutions that I know of on blending the values, not blending, but affirming the values out of our different cultural backgrounds. Going back 10, 15, 18 years ago, I was in the midst at that time of the campus unrest when I was at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And what was emerging about 10 or 15 years ago were specialized study areas in black studies, in Hispanic studies, in Afro-American studies and the like. Most of these have passed now.
And they were designed primarily, the black studies, for the black students to keep them satisfied.
That's pretty much what happened. And students of another culture didn't get into those areas of specialized studies. And I think what we've learned from that, though, is not that those were poor educational tracks, but that we have to find a broader base for more students to get a broader experience of intercultural studies. And this, I think, is the task today. I think it impinges upon us just because of the changing character of our world. Most of our major companies in this country today are multinational companies or related to multinational enterprises. And a lot of our graduates, a lot of our business people, if they weren't trained for it, are being involved in international and intercultural relationships just as a result of those business connections.
So that somebody doesn't produce a goof like one shoe company did, and his ad went into China, like his in appear over the refugees in Burma, Thailand, of a pair of women's shoes against the background of one of their temples. An abomination in their eyes.
Has anybody else had any other experience, or what's the balcony? Are those seats cheaper up there?
Yeah, cheaper seats. You know, to go in, and I really agree with what you're saying in terms of sharing culture, I also think it's important in universities, and I went to a state university, for departments to share information.
Right.
I went through the education department, and it was amazing to me how many people could go through the education department and not even be aware of what issues were currently happening in politics, not being aware of history. And what we do as educators is so affected by all the other research and everything else that's being done. But yet, we're not educated for that, so therefore, when we go in the classroom, we're not teaching that. You know, I guess one of my big, you know, world hunger, you know, the arms race, you know, all that technology, all the ethics and the morality that goes with it, it's just not being shared between departments at universities, so when people get into the professions, they don't share it either.
One of the things that happened from the 1940s down to the present time, and particularly in the large research-oriented universities, is that a department or a discipline or a subject matter became ever more refined. And the more data that surrounded a given discipline, the more specialized it became. So what you describe is exactly what happened. People became so committed to their own focused discipline that the opportunity for cross-fertilization or interdisciplinary studies became greatly reduced. I think the very character of deeper and deeper research into a more and more narrowly defined subject matter creates that, particularly in the large research centers.
That's what you call the specializers. You learn more and more about less and less until you finally know everything about that.
It often happens. And what we need, though, are people who can build those bridges, because the technology that we're having is neutral technology by and large. But it's the application of that technology that makes all the difference in the world about the matter of value. There was a hand back here. Any other experiences at any of your schools or universities or study centers that would say something about intercultural international studies?
Yeah.
When I was at San Jose State, I had a professor who came down from Berkeley to teach an American literature class. It was, I think, the only professor I've ever had who would come in singing, it was usually a bawdy song that had to do with the literature we were reading at the time, but he also talked about the social and economic situation and who was president and what the politics were, and he put it all together so that what you were reading, you know, it was Babbitt and Sinclair Lewis and all this kind of stuff, it had some meaning so that you could look back at that time and understand what was going on and why these authors did that kind of thing. And I think that's the only class I ever had like that. He's still the best professor I ever had.
Where he made an application.
And it was wonderful.
You sound like Alice Wright here, that at a certain time that faculty person hit you at a point of exchange of ideas.
I don't think I've ever had anybody else that did that. It was tremendous. Yeah. And it was exciting, and it made the course he was teaching more interesting, but it also gave you that wealth of background to fill in the gaps.
Good point.
Appreciate it.
Other comments or reactions?
I think that type of thing is done, in my experience, and I'm prejudiced, obviously, because I'm a music teacher, but I know that we do draw in the other influences that are happening. Perhaps I'm not conversant with what is done in the field of art. Perhaps that's done there in art history. But for instance, the period of the Impressionist musicians, also the Impressionist painters, the Symbolist poets, that type of thing, so that the students have an awareness of the whole world at that time. And I know we do, I've seen in other music classrooms too, these charts that show what is happening in thought, in political history, and in philosophy, political history, other world events at the time that we were studying this particular topic. So there's a correlation. Why did it happen? Or when Beethoven wrote his Eroica Symphony, dedicated to Napoleon, you know, the rise of nationalism, that type of thing.
I'm glad you touched on your own field of music, because I didn't draw sufficient attention to the role of art and music and drama and the school newspaper and choral groups and all the rest that really set a kind of tone for liberal learning in many of our colleges and universities that goes beyond the classroom and gives a kind of, a sense of, pardon the pun, but a sense of harmony and a sense of what it means for people to be linked with generations before and generations yet to come, that's conveyed through the music of many generations, through art form and the like. I think that's an integral part of liberal education. I think we've come close to that 5 o'clock time for dinner hour. Thanks a lot for sharing the period.
Thanks.